All right, welcome back to season two of the podcast, where we're having candid conversations, open, honest, vulnerable conversations from people, friends, and clients that I admire. Our intention here is to educate and empower you. We are unscripted, we are live, and today we're diving in with my friend and teacher, Dr. T. Williams. Welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you so much for being here. Why don't we just start with you telling a little bit about yourself, and then we can talk about how we know each other.
Just for our audience, as soon as we got on, we jumped into a juicy conversation. I thought we were going to pick up right there, but you're right. I guess I should introduce myself and all that. Hello, lovely people. I'm Dr. T. For those of y'all who are curious, I have a master's and doctorate in social justice education and a master's in organizational leadership. I do consulting, I do teaching, I do writing, I do speaking, I do liberation work, and I do the healing work that comes with liberation work. And what was the other question? How do we know each other? We know each other because you came and took my Foundations of Social Justice class, and it was delightful having you in class.
Thank you.
Although you took a little bit of a trip there for a minute, and so we missed you for a while. But just out of curiosity, I never asked you how you came to sign up to be in my class.
Yeah, my business coach, Beth Manos-Bricky.
Oh, yeah, Beth.
Had shared that she was joining your next round, and I was like, oh, what is this? And as many magical things happen in the universe, it was just like, I don't know what it was. I was just like, oh, I'm doing this. And I signed up and here I am, was. And then I was so taken aback by the way that you teach, to be honest. I feel like I love the way that you intentionally cultivate community. And it was one of the first times that I've seen somebody in a leadership role just fucking owning like scatterbrained, like ADD and ADHD tendencies. And I was just like, I could just see myself in you so much in that, and I really admired that.
What's one thing that you learned in class that shifted your perspective?
Oh my gosh. I think the biggest thing is, and I've said this, but is learning to genuinely want to understand where other people are coming from in conversations. I've been so hard-headed and wanting to get my own point across, and you really helped me to really listen with a genuine ear to understand where somebody else is coming from, and also help me recognize when I'm having my own shit come up that has nothing to do with the other person, which was like just a mind-boggling blow for me. I'm like, okay, now I know when I need to take a step back and not just keep pushing forward in a conversation, or at least check in with myself. That's a huge theme in my life right now, by the way.
Word. For those of y'all in the audience, the way that we teach that both in Foundations and in my self-awareness class is to notice what is yours and notice what is not.
Yeah. How did you come to get on the liberation framework path?
You want the long version, the short version?
Is there a medium version?
I mean, that's both. How I came to this path. Well, I graduated my undergrad with a degree in psychology and Black studies. I went to work in the governor's office in Illinois, absolutely hated it, and thought about what I enjoyed in my time during undergrad, which is leadership and organizing and organizations and so forth. And I found an organizational leadership program. It was the only graduate program in the country at the time, which was at Gonzaga University. And I looked at the program. It was great. I called the director. He was great. And I applied. I got accepted. And off I went. But the thing is, I didn't, Gonzaga is a Jesuit school. I didn't know what a Jesuit was. I just knew they had a dope program and I liked the director. And so, you know, I didn't visit. I just sort of jumped in my truck and drove across the country. And when I pulled up to the campus and stepped out, I was like, oh, this is an interesting campus. Why are all these cathedrals here? It's a Catholic school. Didn't know that. Boy, oh boy. So I'm walking around and something was just really weird and I couldn't put my finger on it. And then I stopped for a second. I was like, where the hell are the Black people? Yo, there were so few Black people at the time at Gonzaga. I was the only African-American graduate student there.
Oh, wow.
There was a woman who was African from Burundi. There were some African-American law students who I rarely saw because law school and grad school were different places and spaces. So I was in class by myself, and it was an interesting journey. But one of the things that happened there was I did this training of trainers for social justice. And I did it with this woman named Dr. Cindy Gallagher. And Cindy was a lovely human. She was 6 feet tall. She was white. She had super bright red hair, and she was openly gay, which at the time, for me, I didn't know a lot of openly gay people. And I would also say I was fairly homophobic at the time. So okay. In this training, Cindy was kicking white people's asses with race on racism. Like, she wasn't taking anybody's shit. I was like, ooh, I like her. And then she started kicking my shit with gender stuff. I was like, I don't like this, but I like her. So, you know, we did the training. Training was great. I learned a lot. So Cindy and I became friends. And I had this discomfort. I had a bunch of cognitive dissonance in my head, because what I learned from Cindy around social justice very much resonated with me, but it was also very much at odds with the way that I was socialized as a heterosexual cisgender dude. Mm. And, you know, it was chewing up the inside of my brain. It was causing a lot of tension. So I did as much reading as I can, as much research as I could to sort of try and learn on my own. And it just wasn't, I couldn't work my way out of it. So I asked Cindy in the capacity as my friend if she would have this conversation with me, because there's some shit in my head that's there and I don't like it and I don't know what to do with it. Mm. And so we had this conversation, and this at this point was decades ago. And I don't remember most of it, but one thing I do remember is that she said, if your expectation of me as someone who is white is that I will fight against your oppression, my expectation of you as someone who is heterosexual is that you will fight against mine. Mm. And for some reason, that just kind of broke my brain. I was like, wow. Oh, fair.
Yeah.
So here we are decades later, and that line stuck with me. It's been a part of my thinking and framework since she uttered those words, right? So, it was a weird, awkward meeting and all this kind of strange shit. But in the weeks after, that idea just kept flipping around in my head. And eventually I realized that who I was in the present and who I was taught to be historically were not the same person.
Mm.
That the way that I choose to show up in the world is different from the way that I was taught to show up in the world. And then I realized that I am not my socialization, that I get to choose for myself how I show up, what values I espouse, and what values I live on a day-to-day basis. And so after I figured that out, again, that took a minute. I was like,
geez. I was going to say, did that mess you up for a sec?
It did. It really did. It was a difficult journey of unpacking, separating myself and what the people in my life taught me, some of them who loved me very much and still love me very much, separating myself and my values from those values, from my familial values, from some of the values that I was taught in my community, and so forth and so on. So it was definitely a very painful process. But at the end of the day, again, I realized that this stuff that's in my head, this is not what I want for myself. It's not who I am in the world. So I started the process of letting those things go and really thinking about and owning and claiming for myself who I was and who I wanted to be and how I wanted to show up. And so, you know, Cindy and I continued to have multiple conversations and so forth and so on. And finally I said, hey, where'd you learn all this stuff? And she said, over there in the social justice program at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And I said, that's where I'm going. So after I graduated from Gonzaga, I went to UMass and enrolled in that program. And that was very interesting because I was the only African-American heterosexual man in that program.
And
When I got there, there were two gay black men, and they were very standoffish toward me. And that shit hurt my feelings. I was like, ooh, black people. But they were like, I was like, what is wrong with y'all? What I didn't realize at the time, though, is that I probably seemed at that point pretty, I don't know, maybe, I don't think people quite knew what to make of me. Because, so it's funny, I had a dear friend of mine who's gay named Chris, and we have very blunt conversations one day. And he told me, T, you couldn't pass as gay if you wanted to. I was offended at that time. I was like, what do you mean? He was like, listen, my gaydar is perfect. There's no way you could pass. So in the midst of that conversation, like we were joking around, but what I realized is that being heterosexual and black and a man and knowing the kind of like heterosexism that is present in certain places within black American culture, it made sense to me then why these two men were standoffish toward me. They didn't know how to read me. They didn't know if they could trust me.
Yeah.
I was like, also fair. So, you know, I stopped trying to push my friendship onto them. Just sort of, you know, sat back in the cut and just did me. And we had an interaction in class one day, and my friend Torin, at the end of this comment I made, he just sort of looked at me for a minute. He's like, okay, I can fuck with you. And then, like, we became friends from that point forward. But in that program, I had, you know, there are frame bending experiences and frame busting experiences. Mm-hmm. And frame bending experiences are the kinds of things that make us think a little different or alter our perspective. Frame busting experiences are those that make our worldview implode. Mm-hmm. It just goes boom. And we take all the pieces and we stick those pieces together with the glue that is the new thing that we learned. And that entire program was frame busting. Like time upon time upon time in that program, in multiple classes, and very often multiple times within the same class, my mind got blown. It was a powerful experience, but it was also a formative experience in that it radically altered the trajectory of my life and sort of the way that I developed. Part of that was my interactions with sort of sexism, misogyny, and patriarchy, and the way that I learned about that. Because, you know, I was always, I always considered myself a nice guy, right, quote unquote, which is the very lowest of bars for all men. Like, you know, I'm a nice guy. I don't call women out of their names. I've never hit a woman. Come on, I'm lovely. And part of that was that on my father's side, it was a matriarchy. You know, my grandmother ran the show, and I had 17 aunts and uncles, and half of those were women, and, you know, they just didn't take no stuff. So I've always had very powerful women in my life who have always ensured that I've behaved correctly, quote unquote, right? That I wasn't the kind of men that they complained about on a regular basis. But that, too, is kind of a low bar. Yeah. So, I did this weekend workshop. So in order for us to teach about issues of social justice, first we had to take a weekend workshop on the specific thing we wanted to teach. And then we had to observe that from a facilitation and design perspective. And then we had to co-teach it, and then we could teach it. Mm. So the first time that I took that weekend, it was co-taught by a man named Dr. Stephen Botkin, who co-founded an organization called Men's Resources International, which is, first it was the Men's Resource Center, which was partially a counseling center that taught men who were abusive to deal with their stuff, to deal with their anger, to come to grips with their violence, and also teach them better and more positive models of masculinity. So that was one piece. And then the other piece was we did youth development and workshops on misogyny and sexism and all the things. So a great mentor of mine, and he co-led this workshop. And he had a couple there who were a part of the Men's Resource Center. And this is a man who had been through their programs and who now was kind of a peer mentor. And he had been abused as a child by his father, who was violent. And subsequently, he was violent towards his family, his wife and his children. And the person sitting next to him was his wife, who was the person he abused. Okay. And they just had some very direct, blunt conversations about what men's violence looked like in their lives. So, it was a super hard conversation to bear witness to, but also a super important conversation to understand and quite frankly, to be direct in talking about men's violence and the ways that men both enact violence and use the threat of violence as an oppressive tool. So that weekend was super transformational. One of the ways that it was transformational is, and also trigger warning, this is a little bit of a intense comment from the man's wife, who I wish I could remember her name. But when it was her turn to speak, she talked about what that experience was like for her physically and emotionally and spiritually. And one of the things that she said is that it wasn't the black eyes or the broken bones that bothered me. It was the things that he said to me, because my body is healed, but I still I've yet to forget the things that were said. Yeah. And that just sort of, you know, that was like a straight punch to the gut. It was super challenging, but also, again, transformational. So a whole bunch of other stuff happened in that weekend where my head just kept exploding again and again, which is also, it was exhausting, but it was necessary. Right. And so going home on, I don't remember if it was Saturday or Sunday. It was a Friday, Saturday, Sunday workshop. And I just remember going home and I saw a bus roll by, and the bus had an advertisement for elevators of some kind. And it had a woman who had a large bust that was prominently displayed in the ad. And I was like, that's weird. This ad is about elevators. Why would, then I was like, oh, sexism. Like, this is objectification. Wait a minute. So I was like, coincidence, right? It's that old saying of once is an incident, twice is a coincidence, three times is a pattern.
Yeah.
Went home, turned on the TV. I saw commercials, sexism all in the commercials. I saw, well, trying to watch a TV show, sexism all in the TV show. I was like, what the hell is happening right now? I literally had to turn the TV off and go to bed. I was trying to watch the TV to, like, unwind from the day of training, but it just, again, it was more mind-blowing stuff. And, again, it was challenging because, you know, I always, again, consider myself a good guy. And the thing, one of the things that I say in class consistently is that there are certain things that no one tells you when you do this work. And one of those things is that, particularly when you're a beginner, when you start this work, it will cause your worldview to implode. The way that you understand the world will just implode inward. And your self-concept goes with it, because if the world is not as I thought it was, then I am not who I thought I was in the world. And so that's the experience that I had. Fortunately, after that weekend, I was able to get with Stephen and become a part of the Men's Resource Center, which eventually became Men's Resources International, where the organization would travel all over the world teaching men positive masculinity. Yeah. So I also wrote their national and international curriculum, which is awesome. And eventually that curriculum and that organization became folded into another organization that I don't recall the name of at the moment, and where they are focusing on teaching young boys about sexism, misogyny, patriarchy, and all the things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, Men's Resources doesn't exist anymore. Neither the center nor the international organization, but that work still continues. So I was able to get with Stephen, and, you know, working with that group of men was instrumental for my mental health and for unpacking all of the things that I've learned. And it was just an amazing experience. So again, I had experiences like that consistently in that organization. And I was able just to do amazing work consistently. And so where I am now is sort of a natural offset or growth of that whole experience.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing. That's incredible. I look back on my life and I think of like these little things, like the people that you meet and in particular teachers that like, you know, always lead down the path. Do you feel like when I look back on my path at that time, it's just, it helps me realize how much that I'm not alone and that community is important and that it's never just like self-made, like the mm-hmm. bullshit capitalistic stuff. Do you feel that particularly looking back on this story that you just shared?
Oh, 100%.
Story that is your life.
Yeah. So one of the best things about this program is that the program that I was in was led. It was led by women, all women who were extremely powerful in the work that they did, but powerful in different ways, extremely different ways. Mm. So first there was Dr. Jimenez Uñiga, who is internationally known for her work in intergroup dialogue. And I just learned a ton of stuff from her in terms of not only the pedagogy of dialogue, but also facilitation and design. There was Pat Griffin, who is well known in the sports area. Also brilliant, learned a bunch from her in terms of sexism, heterosexism, and gender issues in sports. Also, she was great with facilitation and design stuff. Learned a lot from her as well. And Dr. Marianne Adams, who was somewhat of a tradition. She had all of the skill of a traditional academic, but her thinking was not at all a traditional academic. And so she really tightened up my appreciation of theory and the importance of theory and how to interpret theory, but also how to critique it, and in particular, some of the critique being what they call high theory and its inaccessibility to people who are outside of academia, like how mm-hmm. theory gets created in such a way that it's coded with the keys of higher education, and that shit's all about classism and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But she also made me a much better writer and a much more powerful thinker and critical thinker as it pertains to all of these issues. I probably wouldn't have made it through my dissertation without her. She was instrumental there. And then last, but certainly not least, my friend, teacher, mentor, Dr. Barbara Love, who being in class, you've heard 10 million stories about Dr. Barbara Love. She's just a badass and internationally known badass. And a lot of my thinking is sort of based in her thinking. And one of the things I love about her is that she was always open to co-creating new knowledge with the people that she taught. Mm-hmm. And so I had the opportunity to do lots of co-creation with her. And she was where I began my dive into liberation as distinct from social justice, also as distinct from anti-oppression and DEI and all of these existing frameworks, right? Because there came a point where doing the work of social justice and doing anti-oppression work was not enough. And I honestly, it's funny because I've been doing this work so long. It's just really interesting to see a lot of the concepts and theories from this field that I've been involved in now becoming a part of the mainstream.
Yeah.
And some of that's great, but also some of it is just rough because I don't want to sound like an asshole here, but I'm going to do my best. And if I do sound like an asshole, whatever. part of what's challenging about that is that sometimes these things are taken out of context, and the meaning or the deeper meanings get stripped from them.
Mm.
And so, for example, there's, well, I'm going to leave that one alone. That being said, for myself, it's been a wonderful journey to see these things being included, because when we were first started the program, or when I first started in the program, it received a lot of critique because no one really understood what our program was and what it did. And it was a hybrid program. It's a multidisciplinary program, which made it even weirder. We were those weird leftists or leftist activist people in the School of Id. That's how we were seen by both the School of Id and by the rest of the institution of UMass. And now here we are many years later, having sort of forged a path or created a path for other people. So it's amazing work. And in all of that, though, it's important that everyone here who is listening understand that not everyone who does this work is in agreement about everything.
Hmm.
We have different perspectives. We have different ideas about what the work is. We use different concepts and theories. We have different ideas about what the work should look like, different ideas about what is helpful and unhelpful. And all of those things fit into what we call different frameworks. A framework simply being a structured and organized way of thinking about and understanding a given phenomena.
Hmm.
So I would say that oppression or anti-oppression as a practice has a framework, or a multitude of frameworks, right? Social justice, same thing. Liberation, same thing. And so the framework of liberation comes largely from Dr. Barbara Love, but it also comes from, well, what happened was I burned myself out 3 times doing this work. On the third time, it was like, can't get out of bed, kind of burned out. And eventually I was able to start moving again, but I went to Barbara and said, hey, I can't do this. Like, if this is what social justice means, I'm out. I'm not going to, you know, sacrifice my health. And the thing is, people who do the work of social justice and anti-oppression are notorious for poor self-care.
Mm.
Burning the candle at both ends and in the middle. And so, you know, true to form, that was my MO. So anyway, I had that conversation. Barbara said, you are correct. I am doing, like, I'm feeling much the same. And so I had conversations with colleagues who were also feeling stressed out. And so then under Barbara's leadership, we all got together and did what academics do, which is drink a whole bunch of coffee and eat bagels and donuts and shit, and sat around for several semesters and pontificated. And what emerged from that is critical liberation theory and critical liberation frameworks, which is what I teach.
Wow. Look at that.
That's all the information that you didn't know you wanted.
Okay. I've heard so many things in there. One thing that I'm curious about that I noticed, I think it's interesting. You mentioned that you have strong matriarchal lines in your family, and then you ended up following that path in your career and your life, it seems. Have you ever like drawn that line of connection?
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of strong leadership. I'm also a big fan of strong followership. And therefore, I'm a big fan of knowing which is appropriate when. And in grad school, of course, I did a bunch of activism. And one of the most powerful organizers I've ever met in my entire life is this white Jewish woman named Mishi Lieblum. And Mishi's just a badass. I would follow her ass, like, all throughout hell, turn around and do it again. Like, if I get locked up somewhere, I'm not calling my mama first. I'm calling Mishi, and I'm going to tell Mishi, call my mama. Like, she's just bad. And it's really interesting because, like, in grad school, there were a multitude of moments where there was organizing happening within grad school, outside of grad school, in the communities, and all in between. And this is so weird. I haven't thought about this in a while. I caught a significant amount of flack from a lot of my male, I wouldn't call them friends, a lot of other men in grad school who were part of this activist set, because I was a follower of Mishi. And when I say follower, I recognize how powerful of a leader she is, how effective of a leader she is, and I supported her 100%. If Mishi said, hey, I need or can you, I said yes without question. And I also defended her when things were said about her in spaces and places where she was not present.
Yeah.
And because, you know, this is one of the ways that systems of oppression work, right? They undermine the leadership of the people that are targeted. And so Mishi, being a woman, but also being white, also being Jewish, all of those things came into play. And there were certain conversations that, from my perspective, were deeply, deeply sexist, also misogynistic. And when those conversations were had in my presence, it went down. It always went down. And so, you know, I was accused of only supporting her because I wanted to sleep with her. I was accused of like all kind, any kind of toxic blah, 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 you can imagine that. Yeah, that is what happened. None of those things were true. She was just badass. And I believed past tense, but also continue to believe in her to this day. So that being said, I am very clear that throughout my life, I've had very powerful women in my life through friendships and as colleagues, but also as teachers and mentors.
That's amazing.
It's also, it's been a pleasure. And, you know, I am not at all saying that I don't have work to do. I think one of the things that I am real clear about in our class is that I have made mistakes. I continue to make mistakes, that is a part of the process. And I am not on my high horse in any shape, form, or fashion.
Absolutely. And that structure of helping us, like the self-awareness to think for yourself, especially, just really comes through. I'm losing my train of thought. I was going to like add on to something there, but that's okay.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Let the trains be derailed.
I love it. Okay. Well, the other thing that, that this ties back into the juice, maybe ties back into the juicy conversation we had before record. But so I heard you say that you burned out 3 times and we were talking about patterns and how people tend to repeat patterns that they didn't.
Yeah. So that conversation started because we were doing like a little bit of a check-in. And one of the things that I said in response to something you said was that I'm not a big fan of learning things the hard way numerous times. Mm-hmm. Like if I got to learn it the hard way, I'm going to learn it one time. So I'll give you an example. When I was younger, I bought my first car and it was having some transmission problems. And my Uncle Kevin said, take it to this place to get it diagnosed, but don't let them take it apart. I was like, yeah, whatever. Hopped in the car. I went. I drove it and they took the damn thing apart.
Oh no.
Which meant that I could either pay them 3/4 of what it would take to rebuild it or just pay them to rebuild it because they had already took it apart. They wouldn't charge me to put it back together. So I was hot. I was hot. And my uncle didn't say I told you so. He just looked at me and I was mad. I was like, we ain't ever doing this again. Ever. So from that point, I make it a point to listen to people who know more than I do and who know better than I do so that I don't have to learn things the hard way and I don't have to recreate the wheel, right? I will always seek out the advice and feedback of people who know better. In those instances where I do have to learn it the hard way, we're going to do it one time and one time only. And, you know, patterns, they do what they do. You know, part of what they do is that they hijack our rational thinking and they replace our rational and flexible thinking with a pre-programmed patterned response, which means that, and as a part of that, you know, part of us sort of mentally checks out. We're not fully present. The right. pattern has taken over and is playing itself out. And so that is why some of us, wind up dating the same people over and over and over again. And this is where it started to get juicy. And yes. So when we say dating the same people over and over and over again, we don't mean the literal same person. We mean the metaphorical same person. Some of the same tendencies and same dynamics and same blah, blah, blah. And I'm also not a fan of that. Like exes are exes for a reason. Let us learn from that. We can have a loving friendship if it's possible after the fact, but I'm not doing that again. And then your face got super bright red. That's where we stopped.
Yes, I did. I got super bright red when we're talking about dating the same metaphorical person again and again. And it's because that's what I feel like I've been doing. My big, huge, like, life shift in the last year was in April 2019. I exited a long-term partnership that I had been in. I'd been in the partnership for 3.5 years. I'd known the person for like 15 or 16 years. And then getting out of that partnership, it was all about, I really wanted to focus on myself. And I'd said that a couple times, breaking up with other people. And then I just jump right back into another partnership. I definitely am the type of person that falls in love super easy. And so last year when I exited that partnership, April 2019, it felt like the first time that I was really embarking out for myself. It was like the halt of a because I started dating when I was 14 and my first relationship was 3 fucking years at 14, like 14 to 17. And so I really feel like last year, this exit was like a true disruption of like a dating pattern that had been going on for most of my life. And now I'm here and I'm like, okay, I'm identifying as queer and I'm really feeling into that more. I very much feel the identities of like the she and they, as far as like gender goes. And I'm just really, it's wild being out here right now. I'm like, what do I want?
Out here in these pandemic streets.
Seriously.
What does identifying as queer mean to you?
Yeah, thank you for that question. It means living outside of the binary. That's just like as simple as
the gender binary is what we're talking about.
Yes, thank you. The gender binary. I definitely, there are parts of me and spaces that I very much feel feminine, and I love being in my feminine power and being a woman, and I love that. But I've been feeling more over like the last year how much I really resonate with they, them pronouns. And then in class, when you had made the comment about everyone in the class being cisgendered, and I just like, you know, raised my hand and I was like, actually, I don't. I even startled myself. I had to sit with that for a couple mm-hmm. days after. I was like, oh, really? And then I'm getting into like online dating now, I guess, like safe pandemic dating.
Gosh. And I don't know about that online dating stuff, but yes.
Oh my God.
It's such a jerk. Yeah, that's a different topic.
It is.
So wait, that was when, because I have so many sections of people in my head. I'm trying to remember precisely when I said that. Was that, did I catch myself and correct myself after that, or did I just make that assumption?
Oh no, you corrected yourself. You said, am I correct in assuming, I think you like made the statement and then you were like, am I correct in assuming that we're all right. cisgendered here? Cause I think we are. And that's when I was like, actually, I don't identify just like that.
So just as way of a teachable moment, for the audience and for ourselves, from a facilitation perspective, one of the things that I encourage people to do, particularly in Zoom and other things, is to place their pronouns next to their name, so that we have that diversity of pronouns available and we're normalizing it. And I think the other piece was that be open to challenging your own assumptions. So I think if I remember correctly, I sort of used that as a teachable moment after you said, hey, wait a minute, that's not quite accurate. And that teachable moment is this, y'all, that we will all make mistakes. And I've been doing this work for a minute. And again, I will make those, I make mistakes still to this day. And so what we know to be true about systems of oppression is that they manufacture knowledge gaps intentionally. And so as we go about the work of liberation and social justice and divesting ourselves, we, of course, are going to make mistakes. Now, what is also important to note is that even as we are attempting to divest ourselves and to unlearn and relearn and learn things that are new, we are still being socialized into dominance and or subordination. We still exist within a culture that is continuing to teach us the things necessary that for us to play our roles in an oppressive system. That system also encourages us to play those roles and will penalize us when we do not. And so that is why this concept of liberatory consciousness is so critical, because it is something that enables us to exist outside of that, and in the words of Dr. Barbara Love, to be in the oppression and not of the oppression.
Yeah. And especially for me, in really just like taking it super simple, it's almost like getting comfortable with being wrong and getting comfortable with the unknown.
Mm-hmm. And being willing to name your assumptions, being willing to think about your thinking, being willing to be corrected and offered new information, and. Because if I remember correctly, as soon as I realized that I said that out loud, I thought everyone was in the group was cisgendered, but I also realized that was an assumption that I was making as I was preparing to say it, which is why I asked a question rather than making a statement. Mm-hmm. However, for the purposes of metacognition, which is thinking about our thinking, it's important that we note that the assumption was still in my head.
Mm, yeah.
Now, part of that was at the time where we had class, I was literally teaching 7 days a week. I had a class, a section of foundations every day of the week. And so part of that was I would lose track of ADHD, I would lose track of a lot of information between those sections and things would get convoluted. They're also still convoluted. But that being said, it's a good practice to think about your thinking, to interrupt your own assumptions, and to welcome when people call you in, which when you said, hey, not quite, that was a call in.
Yeah. And it honestly just, it threw me off too. It surprised me. It made me, like I said, have to sit with myself for a couple moments.
Did you identify in the beginning of class that way?
Yes. Yeah, it's been a while, but really, I mean, this year I've been like just challenged to sit with it more and what it means. And I feel really grateful for that opportunity that came up in class. I was just like, so as much as I identify with that, I was starting to realize that I also still resonate with my female identity so much. And I recognize that, especially as I'm recognizing that I'm comfortable getting out into the dating world. Like, I want to date as a female. Like, I love being a female and in my like femininity. And so, yeah, I was sitting with myself before bed the other night and just like breathing and feeling kind of into the energy of like being that, and gave myself permission to be both and to be able to hold both of that, that it doesn't have to be mm-hmm. either or, that it can be both and. And that was really powerful, I would say.
Well, you know what they say, oppression love a binary, which is why we disrupt them in every moment.
Yes. Yeah. And that's like just another, like feels like another full circle moment, like a little thing that I didn't fully realize. And then in so many ways, I'm fucking just in it right now still. Like, oh my God, what is my sexuality and my gender? It's like the big intersection for me right now.
So queer for you is, did we talk about this the other day? Am I wrong about that? Didn't we talk about this a little bit?
I think we have talked about it a little bit.
We were having a conversation about language, and I asked you about queer that time, and you understood it in a similar way, in that it gets used in a lot of ways, and so therefore it functions as kind of an umbrella term that could mean a number of things.
Yeah.
But at the very least, it means existing outside of the binary, the gender binary specifically. So when you say that you want to date as a woman and you're giving yourself permission to be both, what are the, and feel free to tell me like none of your business or this is not relevant, but like what are the ramifications for that for your orientation and like the people that you're attracted to?
Yeah, I think that's where I especially, like, especially identifying as queer, I was, when I realized that I wasn't just just attracted to, like, hetero dudes, men. Mm-hmm. And then also realizing that I've never really explored anything else because I don't feel like it's been encouraged. And then, especially...
Encouraged,
More mainstream encouraged.
Meaning by it hasn't been encouraged in general, in your family, in your life, by your friends, like all of those things?
I mean, like I have family members that are gay and I've definitely have friends that are gay and my family, other family, it was kind of like a little bit of both in my other family members where family says that they're open to it. But then you also like hear comments under the breath about like just, I don't know, some things.
right. That. Yep, I feel you.
So yeah, it just ultimately didn't feel like it was an option for me. Like, it's like, And then even now I tried to explain to like my family, this is how I identify. And everybody says they're okay with it. And my question is like, well, would you really be okay with it if I brought like these certain types of people home to meet you? And like, I don't think they really understand.
Yeah. What that means.
Yeah.
It's also interesting. Like what, okay is necessary, but not sufficient, you know?
Yeah. Right. I like
that's the other, that's the other piece. Like I ain't here to be okay.
Right.
Like we passed them days.
When I just shifting gears a little bit, I do feel like that's something that you and I share. It seems that like happiness perhaps as another value, it comes up a lot for both of us. Like happiness is important for us in our lives. Is that true for you?
100%. And so for myself, that looks a lot of different ways. So for example, I don't do New Year's resolutions. I will do intentions. Mm. And last January, my intention for the year was to cultivate peace of mind consistently and continuously, and to learn to take appreciation in small things. Because for me, my life growing up was so chaotic in so many ways that peace is important for me. And that means peace in my home. It means peace in my relationships. It means, everywhere that I am is where peace can be and should be cultivated. And I'm not unrealistic in terms of, I understand the conflict between human beings happened. They happen in familial relationships, in intimate relationships, in amongst people that you just bump into on an everyday basis going through life. Like I get that. And the way that we handle those are important and they can contribute to or take away from peace and feeling content in the world. So that was my intention for the past year. And I have to say that I feel like I did a pretty good job of that this year. And I think that has sort of enabled me to deal with this pandemic of ours in a way that I don't know that I was equipped to do. Well, that's not true. I was equipped to do it, but I haven't given this part of my life sustained attention in a very long time. So I haven't been using those tools. So that was a very long-winded way of saying yes is the answer to that question. It is important. And those were the pieces that I was working on for myself this year.
That's great. I love that it's so deeply integrated. Does happiness come up as like a main value for you, or does it kind of, because I feel like I have so many like umbrella layers because I can't just pick one. Like,
right. Joy, yes.
Same.
And those are not the same thing. And first, joy is one of the elements of the enactment of liberation, right? It's one of the things that we talked about in class. But also, I was reading The Book of Joy by Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama, and what a powerful book. One of the pieces that I'm still unpacking for myself in my life is something that Desmond Tutu said, which is that I'm paraphrasing. Very much paraphrasing. He said that joy is an internal state that every human being has access to despite external circumstances. Or that may have been my interpretation of what he said. I need to go back and look at exactly what he said, but that's what I landed on after thinking about this for months at this point. And what a thing to say, you know? Mm-hmm. And my first thought was, easy for you to say, Mr. Archbishop man, with your fucking gold crosses in your big church and being loved all over the world.
Right.
And then I had to really think about who was saying this, because that wasn't Desmond Tutu for all of his life. That is where he is now.
Right.
So I had to reconsider that statement in light of remembering that Desmond Tutu was very much an activist during the anti-apartheid movement, and was the person who led South Africa through the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. And, right? This man has done a bunch of stuff. So I'm like, Fine, I will consider this thing you have said. So as I begin to think about it, what I realized is that joy is not a privilege that is given only to those of dominant groups and those of means, right? Joy is 100% a necessity for human beings, and it is the thing that allows human beings to exist and to move through and to survive oppression. Right? It is a powerful and necessary tool for the survival of oppression. And it is a state that each of us can access no matter external circumstances. That means that each of us who have targeted identities can access this space, which means that it doesn't depend on how much money you have or, right? I will also say that, I'm having a hard time unpacking this, right? Because my family is working class. It's hard to feel joyful when the lights ain't on.
Yeah.
Right. And that being said, I still have fond memories of being with and around families in moments where the lights weren't on.
Yeah.
So this is something that I am thinking about and working out for myself. So the, you know, happiness to me is something that is moment to moment. It is something that is sometimes dependent on external circumstances and situations and so forth. Whereas joy is that state of being that we can all access if we're intentional. Yeah. So happiness doesn't resonate with me so much. Like I'm not interested in chasing happiness. I'm interested in cultivating joy.
I love that. And I feel like I say that I've been saying that after every time you share. I love that. I feel like I'm having my own little like implosion here, because I've taken the word happy and happiness and I've ran with it. I have it tattooed on my body, which is fascinating to share and to just think about. But I really think that more than happiness, I've been chasing joy. And it's from a very young age. I just remember seeing people pretending to be happy and lying about it. I mean, you know, kids are so, so open and receptive to that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's just, but how interesting that I've never, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't know how to frame this. So I'm just going to let it out and let's see what happens.
Okay.
This is a liberatory thought experiment. In self-awareness, one of the things that we teach is that sometimes we get in our own way. And one of the ways we get out of our way is take our ego out of the equation. Whether it makes sense or not, say it and let's see what happens. So that is what we're doing. We're having a thought experiment. I experience you as a joyous person.
Oh, that's quite a big compliment, I feel like.
I'm glad you see that as such, although it wasn't meant to be. It was just a statement of fact. Like, that is how I experience your person, your energy, your smile, your sense of humor, your engagement. Like, you have that positive energy, affirming energy. You have great attention, which may sound like a weird thing, but one of the most powerful tools that human beings have is our ability to give our attention. And when you learn to utilize your attention for liberatory purposes, you will notice that different human beings give different kind of attention. Right. Like, it feels different, right? Yeah. And so the way that I experience you is as someone who's joyous.
Thanks for breaking it down like that. I'm taking it in. I'm like,
let me know what you make of what you're taking in.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just interesting. Thank you for seeing me. Thank you for seeing me. Everything you have shared resonates. It does feel true to who I am. And it's also just fascinating to recognize that this is like naturally who I am and who I've been my whole life. And then over the course, especially of like the last few years, really learning about like becoming more trauma informed and understanding like the depths that you like the actual work you have to do to really tap into that joy and for it to be like sustainable. And I think I really did go for happiness. I was going for happiness as a kid. I didn't know any better. And like now that I'm an adult and I'm find myself on this life path, I'm like, oh shit. Like, it's not just like love and light. You got to go through the salt and the shadows to be able to really tap into joy. And it's joy, not happiness.
You know, I have mixed feelings on that.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is because I think, I gotta be careful. I'm just, we're in an experiment.
Yes, we are.
Yes, we are. So I feel like joy as an internal state and a way of being and showing up in the world, that is the birthright of every human. And I think trauma can definitely impact that 100%.
Yeah.
And I also think sometimes you have to go through the trauma to get through the joy, but also sometimes you have to get to the joy, or you have to use the joy to get through the trauma. That it's not a one-way street. That the relationship between those things as healing modalities and ways of being fully human are reciprocal.
Very much so.
So I give an example. In Rwanda, after the end of their civil war, the UN sent in, you know, a bunch of Western trained psychologists and to help the people who were there deal with the aftermath of that ethnic cleansing, which is truly what it was. And, it just wasn't working, right? There was the Rwandan people invited those psychologists to leave because the way that they were attempting to help the healing of the Rwandan people was misaligned culturally speaking and made things worse.
Yeah.
And that in one one interview I was reading, one woman was talking about how being forced to relive those things over and over and over again destroyed the, or almost destroyed the little bit of her that was left. Mm-hmm. And she said, for us, that is not healing. For us, what is healing is the sun. For us, what is healing is community. What is healing for us is dancing and singing and moving. Those things, like joy, those things are what is healing for us. And so I guess to bring it full circle with this experiment, what you said prompted that thought, because you said you have to go through the shadows to get to the joy. But my thought is, when you cultivate the joy, it helps you get through the shadows.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Because it's never just one way.
But also, I feel like when we're talking about the differences between those two things, we're talking, it's similar to the differences between anti-oppression and liberation.
Mm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I do.
Like, in cultivating joy and utilizing that joy to help us get through it, we're orienting our attention on the things that we want rather than the things that get in the way of what we want.
Yes.
And I'm not saying that, like, listen, whatever way you need to do this work in order to heal, do it that way. But I feel like Western psychologists in specific will place an emphasis on doing all that shadow work and going through all of those things, reliving them, blah, blah, depending on the modality, first as the way to healing. Mm. And other people, places, spaces, and practices say, cultivate that joy in community, right? Play with people. Those things will give you what you need to move through the darkness and get to the healing.
Yeah, having the tools, like being equipped with the tools before you just like head out into the dark.
Yeah, but also, again, it's a place of where you are orienting your attention.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? If you're orienting your attention toward joy and toward the things that bring you joy, and you're intentionally engaging in healing, right, of walking through those places that bring you pain, your attention is still on becoming who you want to be in the world, experiencing the world as you want, rather than getting through this rough place in order to experience the world that you want to, in the ways that you want to experience it.
Mm.
I don't know if that makes sense or not.
I do think I need to take it in for a second, but it does make sense. And I thank you for breaking that down and shifting it around, because I've been really about like moving through the darkness, and I really appreciate that different, like, let's break this down and look at it different.
That is called a liberatory reframe.
Oh, okay.
Specifically. Basically, yeah. Like, you know, it's a reframe, it's taking a situation, looking at it from a different perspective. That's a reframe, right?
But yeah.
This is taking this situation and being intentional about looking at it from a liberatory perspective, using mm-hmm. that framework, those concepts, and that language.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Look at that joyous face around your cheeks.
I have a last question for you.
Yeah.
Is you... We're taking it full circle back to the beginning, where you had said, like, at the beginning of your path at Gonzaga, you started learning about the process of letting things go. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious. I have a lot of people reach out to me often and ask, like, what does that mean? How do you do that? Like, I feel like I'm holding on to this shit and I'm ready to let this stuff go. Like, what is letting go?
Ooh. Honestly, it looks a lot like what we do in class.
Mm.
And part of that is, from the very beginning, clarifying your values, being very thoughtful and intentional about a process that of discovery that will enable you to understand what things are most important to you. And then actively using those values as tools, rather than as a statement. Mm. So for myself, I was going through some stuff, and there was a lot of ambiguity, and there was a lot of fear, and there was a lot of, I was stuck, right? And then that is not a place that is comfortable for me. And when I land there, I let myself be there for a little bit, and then I move myself through it. And so one of the ways that I move myself through it is by checking in with my values. Mm. And one of the questions that I asked myself that really leveraged me out of that spot was, on my deathbed, right? When I am ready to transition from this world, when I look back on this situation, number one, will I be proud of the way that I handled this? Number two is, would I be able to say that I handled this to the best of my ability and in alignment with what I believe? And then finally, again, on my deathbed, looking back, will this be of significance?
Mm.
9 times out of 10, the things that we struggle with truly are not that important.
Yeah, seriously.
Like, and when I realized that, I was like, I got real clear real quick with those three questions. Yeah. After I thought about those three questions, it became clear to me like, I know what I got to do here. I'm good. And from that moment forward, me and these people that I had conflict with who were, exerting some really problematic pressure on me. Oh, after that point, we just went at it and we wound up having to get the state involved, and we had to have a couple of hearings and blah, 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 blah. End of the day, they lost. I won.
Okay. And you were in alignment with your...
100%. 100%. Because at the end of the day, I got a chip on my shoulder when it comes to authority. Like,
yeah.
I don't like to be told you can't just because someone perceives that they have the ability to say you can't. Like, I am of the belief that unreasonable rules do not apply to me.
I completely agree.
Right. So, like, at the end of the day, this is all unreasonable, and my value, and I knew that once I was able to leverage these questions and use my values as a tool for alignment. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Doing that, once again, that clarity came quick, action came quick, and then the results didn't come as quick, but I had no control over that. So,
yes. There you go. Great. Yeah, I feel like that is a lot of what I also strive to share and teach in my Well Self course. I had reached out to you and said I teach about values and I wanted to use your exercise for my course. And that's part of that, I think, is just it's like helping people understand who they are and then feel like they have those tools to continue to like really be in that foundation as you go out and decide like who you want to be in the world and how you show up and all of that. But mm-hmm. I especially love that you also are bringing in like the deathbed, because at least for me, death has been, it's just been very prominent in my life for better or for worse. And mm-hmm. It really has driven me on my path as well, along with not being surrounded by people that are genuinely happy, but knowing that death is real, it's inevitable. We're all headed for it. So like, I remember so specifically in my teens being stuck on what if you died tomorrow? Like, would you be happy with your life? And then it's like just slowly trying to work through like actually feeling okay if I did pass, like, I'm doing my best. I'm showing up. I'm trying to be a good human in the world. Which I mean, obviously has so many layers.
Yeah, it does. And I think, maybe that's a different conversation, but for me, the deathbed, it was about being clear that I'm being true to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the midst of a situation where someone is attempting to force me into a corner to make specific decisions or to engage in a specific way, that is very much antithetical to who I am. Like, my mom said, my first word was no. Like, and I said it consistently and repeatedly to everything. And that is very much true to my character. Like, I am going to be who I am in the world. Right. Yeah. And if that means that that I have to take the road less traveled, because that is a part of how I show up in the world, I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
Because my integrity means something. My alignment means something. My values mean something. And being able to show up in alignment with my values and with authenticity consistently, for me, is a great springboard into the consistent experience of joy.
Yeah. Wow. Like,
when people are forced to exist in the world in ways that are antithetical to who they are, it is a miserable experience.
Yes.
Done that to myself one time. Never do it again. I learned that lesson.
Oh my gosh. Oh, I wish we could just, maybe next season I'll do like 3-hour conversations, but we're coming up on a wrap for this episode. Is there any last thing that you would like to share or leave anybody with?
What a question. Ooh. Yes, I guess my final thought would be take responsibility for your learning. And it's one of the things that I say consistently to people that take classes with me. Like, I have a bunch of stuff in my head, and as much as I would like, I can't like unscrew my head and pour it all out for you. There's, you know, there's only so much time that we will spend with each other in that capacity. And I will do everything I can to share everything I can to help people learn, evolve, grow, and heal. But at the end of the day, each of us is responsible for cultivating peace and cultivating joy or not. Each of us is responsible for learning the things that we need to learn and the tools that we need to have, and also for having the experiences that we need to have in life. So take responsibility for that, accept responsibility for that, and move forward with joy. Yay.
With joy. Thank you so much, Dr. T.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. This is fun.
Thank you so very much for taking the time to tune into our conversation today. I hope that you're feeling empowered, fired up, inspired. And if you're really feeling like you want to dive a little deeper, don't forget I have plenty of free resources available to you on my website, as well as a handful now of online courses, including an online movement space that will be coming again, reopening this fall 2020. You can also sign up to have your own little candid conversation with me if you so desire, not recorded and in fact completely confidential. I offer self-care consults on a sliding scale, so you can feel free to check that out if you'd like some personalized, judgment-free lifestyle and stress management advice. Thank you for being here. Thank you for supporting me. And most of all, really, thank you so much for taking care of yourself. Yeah, let that sink in for a minute. Thank you for taking care of yourself. The world needs more people doing just that. Cheers to a conscious way of living, y'all. For ourselves, for our communities, and our planet. Until next time.